Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, Hillary Clinton makes an unusual appeal to Mormon voters. Meanwhile, Governor Gary Herbert says he'll vote for Donald Trump. Also, renewed calls for the release of body cam footage after the Salt Lake County District Attorney finds police justified in the shooting of a teenager. Plus, a new report says ozone pollution leads to a dozen deaths or more a year in Salt Lake City. We'll be discussing those and other stories on the show today. And joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Justice reporter Jessica Miller. Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist George Pyle is with us as well. George, welcome.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can join this conversation as well by putting your comments and questions in the comments section at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Robert Gerke. Hillary Clinton reached out to Utahns this week with an op-ed in the Deseret News. What was her pitch to voters here in Utah?
Well, she made a pitch based on sort of religious freedom, religious tolerance, and sort of disparaged, I guess, Donald Trump for saying that he's, that his rhetoric against Muslims and trying to ban Muslims from coming into the country is contrary to the shared values of this country and the Mormon Church. She specifically cited several Mormon leaders, you know, from Joseph Smith on up to Thomas Monson, mm-hmm. as being, you know, people who've advocated for sort of a stronger together approach. She quoted the former primary president, Sister Wixom, and so it was very much written in the vernacular of the Utah LDS voters, and I think it was a fairly remarkable direct pitch to these people who might be disenchanted with the Republican nominee.
Well, and she also, I understand, cited or referenced the words of Mitt Romney, who has been obviously very critical of the GOP nominee Donald Trump.
She did. She said, you know, I think it was something to the effect of, you don't have to take my word for it. Listen to, you know, Mitt Romney, and you invoke Mitt's name in Utah, and it suddenly has, you know, a certain resonance to it. And so, you know, it was an interesting attempt, and it sort of harkens back to what the Democrats did at their national convention, where they tried to make this pitch to sort of, to God and country and, you know, better and, you know, looking to the future and just sort of an upbeat, you know, shared values message that they're trying to appeal to these middle of the road sort of disenchanted Republican voters or independent voters who might be leaning Republican in most elections
around the country.
And
the idea being that states that might not have been competitive, you know, in previous elections this time around because of this unusual cycle are competitive, Utah being among them,
right.
Conceivably. Let's talk about that in a minute. But
yeah.
What is the reaction to Clinton's appeal in the Deseret News been by, say, the Utah Republican Party or others in the community here
right.
who have read it?
Well, so James Evans, who's the chairman of the Republican Party, said it was pandering, you know, and he dismissed it, said that, you know, if we know one thing about Hillary Clinton, it's that she's comfortable being whoever she needs to be in front of whatever audience she's speaking to at the time, you know, sort of a chameleon kind of factor. He said he doesn't think it's gonna play because he said, you know, one editorial doesn't dismiss or doesn't invalidate 30 years of actions. You know, the actions speak louder than words. And so, they dismissed it, obviously, but that's to be expected.
And I'm assuming that the Utah Republican Party and James Evans have come out in favor of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, he's the party's nominee. James is supporting him, and he says he's going to win in Utah. And he actually said at the Republican convention, win by the largest margin in the country. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but...
In addition, Clinton yesterday, Clinton publishes this op-ed earlier this week, and then yesterday her husband, Bill Clinton, appears at a fundraiser yesterday in Park City, and I hear that some people paid a really hefty sum to get into this.
Right. Well, I mean, some people did, and the ticket started about $250, just to be clear. he's not coming to town for $2.50, a cup of coffee for Bill Clinton. So they started about $250 up to about 10 10,000 for, you know, a VIP sponsorship, and then to be a co-host, it's up to 33,000. And that money goes both to the campaign and to the Democratic National Committee. It gets split up and then used for, you know, various efforts.
Sure. And I know that reporters weren't allowed into this event itself, but people who attended the event told you that he echoed some of the statements or some of the comments or the themes that Hillary made.
Going to sort of the message of shared values. These are you know, Hillary's values, and these are Utah values, and they coincide. They overlap more with, you know, Hillary's values overlap more with Utah values than Donald Trump's, who, you know, he said, you know, he wants to take us back 50 years. And if you look back 50 years, it was not a good time for women in the workplace or you know, African-Americans or gays who were forced to live in the closet. That was sort of the message that, you know, we're going to move forward. And Hillary shares your values as Utahns and as Americans.
And after this fundraiser, Bill Clinton makes his way to Salt Lake City, and he meets with a number of officials here as well.
Right. He met for probably about 2 hours with a group of you know, business leaders. Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams was there. And while he was there, they kind of, some of these were Republicans, Kem Gardner and Natalie Gochner. Kem Gardner's not a Republican, but he has supported Republicans in the past. You know, I guess the discussion was essentially, you know, we're worried about the partisanship in Washington, and we need solutions. And you know, there were a lot of questions asked and a lot of back and forth. And then on the way out, Bill stopped to shake some hands with some people who'd kind of gathered outside on the way to his motorcade. So it was a quick trip, you know, and I think probably, you know, not really any public events, because I think mostly they were focused on raising the money right now.
Sure.
I suspect, you know, though, that we might see somebody like Tim Kaine come to town at some point, you know, because, again, even if you're not putting Utah in play per se, you're at least turning up the heat, putting pressure on the Trump campaign, then they have to respond in some way.
Well, and maybe spend their own money here in the state. You know, we've heard about the high expectations on the part of Democrats during this election cycle, and I'm wondering what the polling shows right now as far as Utah's competitiveness goes.
Well, the most recent poll came out this week, and it was UtahPolicy.com did one with Dan Jones and Associates, and it said that Trump was sitting at about 37%, Hillary was at 25%, and Libertarian Party nominee Gary Johnson was at 16%, which was a big bump for Johnson since their last poll. He had been at about 10. Previously. So it shows us a couple interesting things. One is that, you know, Gary Johnson was the Libertarians nominee 4 years ago. He was on the ballot and he got 1% in the state. Now he's sitting at 16%, I think, which shows you that there's 15% of the voters who in this state who are looking for somebody else, and they've settled on him. I mean, I don't think we can attribute all of that to Gary Johnson suddenly becoming this national phenomenon, right? So I think he's kind of capturing some of those discontented voters, probably both from Clinton, you know, maybe some of the Sanders supporters, and also from Trump. The you know, there's a 12-point spread right now. One of the wild cards, I think, right now is, well, one thing is the poll was done over both of the conventions. They were out in the field during both the Republican and Democratic conventions, so that may have had some impact on it. But there was sort of the one wild card right now is this Evan McMullen, who is
And I want to get to him. He's somebody who has come into this from the outside. Is a Utahn who has thrown his name in to try and capture, I guess, other people who might be disaffected by, I'm assuming, Trump as he's coming in as a Republican.
Yeah, he's sort of billing himself as the Never Trump alternative. He's, you know, the conservative option for disenchanted Trump voters. It's hard to know right now how legitimate his candidacy is going to be. You know, he comes in people don't really know much about him other than that he worked at the CIA, worked in investment banking for a period of time, and most recently has been working for Congress as a policy advisor. But it's hard to know how legitimate he's going to be. It's hard to know where his money is going to be coming from. It's going to be hard for him to get on the ballot in a lot of states. But in Utah, he has a good chance of getting on the ballot. You only need 1,000 signatures, and he's got until Monday to do it. And if he can get on the ballot, you know, you can see him starting to eat into both the Trump supporters, who, you know, maybe people who didn't like Trump, but they stayed with him because they didn't like Gary Johnson and Hillary Clinton's not an option. You know, there's got to be some universe of people where he can tap into that. And then, you know, maybe I also anticipate that he'll take some of those Trump supporters from Gary Johnson, you know, and so, or not Trump supporters, Trump opponents from Gary Johnson's camp.
That sounds beneficial to Hillary Clinton in Utah.
You start fracturing the vote more and more, and you start seeing a little path to daylight. And as, you know, we've said on here numerous times, Utah's a state that hasn't gone for a Democrat since 1964. Hillary Clinton is still going to have a hard sell because she's not well liked in Utah. In fact, she's less well liked than Trump is, and so it's going to be a hard road for her. But you start fracturing that vote different ways, and you can see a path to a potential victory at least.
George Pyle, Utah again, as Robert's saying, hasn't been in play in a presidential election for decades, but seems more competitive now. Maybe Evan McMullins, if he has a candidacy that is accepted and he can get on the ballot, that could have an effect as well. It's an unusual election year. This has to be great fodder for an editorial writer like yourself. What are you seeing here?
Back to the Utah Republican caucus in, when was it, March? Mm-hmm. When Donald Trump came in a distant third, where he was steamrolling over everybody every place else, he came in a distant third here. Sanders beat Clinton here as well, so right. We were looking for something new. And, you know, the national punditry has been taking note of that. George Will and McKay Coppins and Ralph Douthat have all been writing about, you know, thank goodness for those Mormons. They can stand in the way of Donald Trump because they have moral values and they care about things that Donald Trump just steps on. I mean, the internet meme is, can you imagine Hillary Clinton standing at the convention podium with five children by three different husbands, and how well that would go over in America, much less in Utah.
So, well, Joseph Smith did it when he ran for president.
Well, that's true, but they've kind of turned their back on that now, at least officially. So, and you know, the persona of Donald Trump just rubs a lot of people, not just Mormons, the wrong way. I mean, Gary Herbert the other day was saying that he was still going to support the nominee of his party, although in his mind he was voting for Mike Pence for vice president.
Right.
Now, a lot of people think this is all just a big joke, that Donald Trump's just running so that he can come out of this and start his own TV network and take over for Roger Ailes, I guess. I don't know. And I know people who say, you know, that Chelsea and Ivanka are buds from a long way back, and this is all just a big ruse. This is a plot that Trump will run for president. He'll be so outrageous and so ridiculous that nobody will vote for him, and people who would have, you know, been tired of Clintonism will say, I guess Hillary. And the longer this goes on and the more ridiculous things he says, the more that almost starts to make sense. I'm not big on conspiracy theories generally, but...
Well, you're saying that it makes sense, except for the fact that it isn't panning out the way that you would imagine.
No, this is the monster that got off the slab and is running through the village, and he might actually win. Now, Nate Silver has his Trump's chances of winning at 13%.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, there's battlefield states like Pennsylvania. He absolutely has to win Pennsylvania. He absolutely has to win Ohio. And then you have the situation where Utah and Arizona, and Nevada with large Mormon populations might put the whole thing in play because they can't stand Donald Trump as a person, even though they tend to vote Republican.
Right.
Then the third party candidates get more attention. The newcomers get more attention. As you go down the ballot, do people vote for Hillary because they can't stand Donald, and then do they vote for more Democrats?
And I want to get to that. What happens down ballot in these down ballot races as a result of this election cycle? But I just before we leave presidential politics, I want to Robert Gerke, you mentioned Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson, and his polling better now in Utah than he has in previous polls. He made some comments about Mormons that some people thought might have had a negative impact on voters here, but that, I guess, based on the polling, doesn't seem to be.
Well, I think the polling was finished before those comments were made. He was doing sort of a media scrum and said, you know, they were talking about religious liberty and protections for religious beliefs. You know, this is, goes back to sort of the old, you know, can you force somebody to build, make to bake a cake for a gay wedding? And he said that, you know, he thinks that he doesn't, he's uneasy with the people who want to claim religious liberty as a grounds for discrimination. And he said it can lead you down a slippery slope, but basically you can end up where people, you know, like Mormons are going to shoot somebody because God told them to. Hmm. And you know, obviously the connection between Mormons and sort of divine inspired violence was did not sit well with a lot of Mormons. He tried to clean it up a couple days later by saying, you know, well, no, what I was talking about was the persecution of Mormons. Mormons have obviously been, you know, experienced tremendous persecution in their past, and right. And I wasn't trying to be offensive, but I didn't articulate it very well. And he also came out and embraced sort of the what's been become known as the Utah Compromise, the you know, the legislation that passed a few years ago to protect gays and lesbians from housing and employment discrimination in
while
exchange
enshrining.
While enshrining some protections for religious individuals as well. So he tried to clean that up. I don't know. I don't think we can say to what extent it did damage. I don't know how widespread the comments were, but probably not the way you want a message to, you know, if you want to look at an effective message to LDS voters and an ineffective message to LDS voters, you probably look at Hillary Clinton's, the way her tone in that versus the way Gary Johnson couched it.
Well, time will tell, obviously. We're going to have to take our first break here on Behind the Headlines. But when we come back, we will stick with politics for just a little bit longer and look at the 4th Congressional District race. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young. As the Olympics enters a second week, we'll take a look at the men's and women's marathon. Americans Galen Rupp and Shalane Flanagan are among the top contenders. And gender equity and sports. Women Olympians are facing a lot of challenges in and out of competition. That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Next time on Ask Me Another, director Ira Sachs and actor Jennifer Ely talk about their new movie, Little Men. And when Jennifer's not acting, turns out she's raising chickens.
Well, we only have 2 chickens
okay,
at the moment.
Okay. That's okay.
We had 7 2 weeks ago, but something ate 5 of them.
Was it you?
No.
Join me, Ophira Eisberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
That's Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined in studio this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Jessica Miller, Emma Penrod, and George Pyle. Again, you can join this conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Robert Gerke, we were talking about the race for the White House before we went to the break, but there are also, of course, down-ballot races, one of which is our 4th district race for Congress. What's happening in the race between Mia Love and Doug Owens in the polls, in fundraising?
Yeah. So in the most recent poll, the Utah Policy poll we mentioned, Mia Love actually had a sizable lead, and this sort of mirrors an internal poll that her campaign released a couple weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, I guess. It said that the most recent poll said that Mia Love was ahead 51 to 38, which is a 13 point lead. It's sizable because she beat him by about 5% 2 years ago. The Tribune poll that came out in June actually showed Doug Owens with a lead, and so either this is a polling anomaly or the race has changed significantly. I almost wonder if it's the former, because you've got a situation where there hasn't been that much actual campaigning being done yet. Both of these candidates have reserved large amounts of airtime, but we haven't seen them sort of saturating the airwaves, as I'm sure they will. And so it's hard to see anything in that race that would necessarily have driven that kind of swing. So I think what we might have here is a little bit of a polling anomaly, but it does look like, at least, that Mia Love does have According to both her internal poll and to this new Dan Jones poll, it does have a lead on the Democrat Doug Owens, which frankly isn't that surprising. I mean, like I said, she beat him last time. The campaign is just getting underway, and I think it's probably a reflection of where the race is.
Well, not surprising, but again, Democrats have been hopeful that this Trump effect will benefit them, that maybe people won't come out and vote. Mm-hmm. Could the polling? I guess the polling is probably of likely voters.
The polling was of likely voters, yeah. And, but there is also, people say they're likely voters and don't necessarily always vote. The issue with the down ballot voting is that not just you're not just looking at the Trump-Clinton campaign, although, frankly, both candidates have tried to, saddle each other with their party's respective presidential nominee. Doug Owens has tried to distance himself from Hillary Clinton, and the Republicans have said, well, you gave money to Hillary Clinton, in 12 years ago. I can't remember when it was. And then Doug Owens is trying to, pin Donald Trump on Mia Love. But you've got, there are other races on the ballot that, depending on how competitive they are, and it looks like right now that they may be not the most competitive races, both the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race. If you have a dog of a ticket at the top of the presidential level, and you have two other races that maybe aren't real competitive, it could depress turnout. And what that kind of does more than anything, I think, is heightens the organizational efforts of the campaign, because now you've got 20 out of 29 counties that do mail-in voting. They identify these voters that request the ballots in advance and pester them until they get their votes in.
Right.
That becomes that much more important. And I will say this, that Mia Love's campaign has, she's got Dave Hansen running her campaign. He did this for Orrin Hatch several years ago and did it very well. They've got a very sophisticated project going. I haven't seen Doug Owens' organizational efforts, so I can't comment on that. But that just becomes that much more important, especially if turnout's low.
And probably leads to, I would imagine, greater spending in these races. Fourth Congressional District, for example, has been one of the most expensive races in elections passed.
Right. Yeah. And Mia Love's campaign so far has reserved about $1 million worth of TV time. Doug Owens, not the campaign, but the House Majority PAC, which is the Democratic Congressional Committee's PAC, has put down, I think, almost $380,000 to almost $400,000 in TV time. It's going to be a battle on the airwaves, and it's also going to be, like I said, an organizational fight. And so, I think the National Party has sort of listed Doug Owens as one of their top contenders, one of their top targets for this cycle, and I think it's likely that we're going to see a lot more money pouring into this race than we did 2 years ago, where frankly, I mean, the Democratic National Party just stayed out of it, and maybe regretted that decision because it did end up being a little bit closer than a lot of people
had expected. George Pyle, comments on either discrepancies in polls or maybe the down ballot effect, how competitive some of these races might be.
Well, people who watch politics for a living kind of wonder about, you go into the poll and you vote for the Republican for president, and then do you vote Republican all the way down, or are you sophisticated enough to think, well, Republican for president, but that's too much power, so I'll vote for Democrats for Congress, or the other way around, so that government is balanced. And government has been, Democrat president, Republican Congress, or the other way around for a long time. So sometimes you wonder, are voters that sophisticated that they go in there and do that on purpose? Or is it just, as Tip said, all politics is local and it's not the party so much as it is the person? This is a really weird year the debates have been going on forever. The presidential race has sucked all the air out of the room. And it's almost like when these local ads start showing up, it's going to be, oh God, we've got another election to worry about, and you just turn off the TV.
Well, you make it a really interesting point too, though, because I would need to check the numbers on this, but my memory says about a quarter of the voters vote straight ticket. If Donald Trump is not going to be doing well, you're going to see a lot less of that straight ticket voting, and people are going to be splitting ballots, and that could also be an unknown, just sort of a wild card in this sort of an election cycle.
I'm sure there's some education campaigns going on behalf of the parties to just show people how to vote that when you're not voting.
Skip that first one and go on down and vote Republican.
Well, I want to turn to other stories, and I mean, that's a lot of races to watch in politics, but also on the government and politics beat this week was news that the state would pay for some legal fees for a bill the legislature passed, a kind of bill gone wrong, I guess. Mm-hmm. What was this bill, and why was it challenged? And tell us about these legal fees, Robert.
Gertie. Well, so several years ago, I guess this was 2012, there was this group called the Proper Role of Government Education Foundation, I guess, that was targeting Representative Brad Daugh down in Orem with just hammering him. I mean, they were doing auto dial calls to his voters. They were sending mailers in. They were putting up paying for lawn signs. And nobody really knew where their money was coming from. And it wasn't until a couple of years later when there was this investigation of John Swallow that we come to find out that John Swallow's political consultant, Jason Powers, had created this group funded primarily by the payday lenders to target people who had tried to impose regulations on the payday lending industry. And they were very successful. They took out Brad Daugh in that election. They went after Sean Reyes, who was John Swallow's opponent, with money. Again, from the payday lending industry. At the time, Representative Greg Hughes, who sort of on Daugh's behalf ran this bill to try to force these groups into disclosing where their money was coming from, because as it turns out, they didn't have to disclose really anything about who their donors were, and they were pumping money into these political campaigns. So the legislature passed this bill that was just to require nonprofits to file some disclosure of who their donors were.
This is nonprofits who were involved at all in lobbying.
If they spent more than $750 on a political campaign, and not just political campaign, it includes ballot initiatives and so forth. Well, so the Utah Taxpayers Association and the Libertas Institute, a libertarian sort of think tank here in town, they sued to challenge this, and the state ultimately backed down. They capitulated and said, you know what, this is probably unconstitutional. They said that requiring us to disclose our donors because we are engaged in constitutionally protected political speech is a violation of our free speech rights. The state, again, backed down, agreed to not enforce the law, and as a result, there's going to have to pay this group that represented these two nonprofits $125,000 for their legal fees. And, you know, it's sort of this ongoing push and pull, and we've seen it at the national level, too, where you try to get disclosure of where, you know, whose money is influencing these races, and you've got these networks of nonprofits that don't have to disclose. They call it dark money or shadow money. And it's, you know, it's becomes impossible, and they pour, you know, literally, not in Utah alone, but nationally, it's tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into these political campaigns without any sort of, without the voters really knowing who's trying to change their minds. But again, after Citizens United, it's very difficult to, try to impose any disclosure requirements, and I guess that Utah will be back to the drawing board and trying to figure out how they might be able to do this legally and going forward.
And in the meantime, is on the hook for the legal fees for these groups that challenged this.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, we've covered a lot of politics so far on the show, and I'd love to turn to other topics. finally. And so, Jessica Miller, on the Justice Desk, we found out this week that there won't be any criminal charges in the shooting of a teenager in Salt Lake City's Rio Grande District earlier this year. I guess first, let's maybe try and revisit what happened in that original story, or at least the outline of what happened, because we don't have exactly, there are conflicting stories about what precisely happened.
Right.
But how did this break?
Well, there actually are criminal charges, not for the police officers, for the teenager that was shot by the police.
Correct.
Basically, in February, there were two police officers who were responding to the Road Home shelter on a stolen cell phone report, like pretty regular stuff. And while they were there, they spotted this assault. Apparently, or allegedly, this 17-year-old kid, Abdi Muhammad, was involved in some sort of drug deal, maybe, involving methamphetamine. Apparently, this dispute with this other guy, and so the police see this assault. They see this 17-year-old assaulting this man with a metal rake handle. And so they yell for the teen to put the rake handle down, and he doesn't, and so they shot him four times. But that's the police's or Simgill's version of events. There's been other accounts that the man that was assaulted had a knife and that the teen was protecting himself, but as to what really happened, it's not really clear yet.
Not totally clear, and maybe could be clearer. There were calls initially for body cam footage to be released early on. That didn't happen, and the Salt Lake City police at the time said that that footage could be used as evidence, as we said, in charges brought against Abdi Mohammed, which has now happened. There have been charges brought against him for assault and for theft?
No. Initially, they didn't release the body cam, saying that it was part of the investigation on whether the officers were justified in using potentially lethal force. Now, with that investigation over, the day earlier this week on Monday, when District Attorney Simgill announced that the officers were justified, he also announced that they were charging the teenager in juvenile court with aggravated robbery, which is a first-degree felony, and possession of drugs with the intent to distribute, a second-degree felony. And they're trying to get that case bumped up into the adult court. And now Sim has said that because of this ongoing prosecution, they still can't release that body cam video because it's become evidence in their case against Abdi.
Okay, so still not able to release it. What was you mentioned that Simgill, you know, called the shooting justified. How did he describe what happened and his rationale for calling for not bringing charges against the officers or not having some sort of disciplinary action brought against the officers?
He said that the officers believed that Abdi was about to seriously injure or perhaps kill the man who was being assaulted. They weren't really sure what he had in his hand. They might have thought it was like a pipe or a sword or something like that. And so he ruled that they had a reasonable belief that Abdi was causing serious harm or perhaps death to this person. After the assault was over, I think that the assault victim, he had some welts like on his arms or his back. So he didn't have serious injuries, but...
I guess maybe we should talk about what happened to Abdi Mohammed after he was shot. He ended up in the hospital. He was in a coma for a short period of time.
Yeah, he was in a coma for about 2 weeks, medically induced coma, and then he was hospitalized for a couple weeks after that. And now he's using a wheelchair now. I'm not sure if that's permanent. His attorney that we talked to earlier this week, he didn't have many details about his medical prognosis, so I'm not sure if that's permanent, but he is using a wheelchair at this point.
Okay. There's a group, Utah Against Police Brutality, that obviously, well, not obviously, but that was unhappy with this decision by the DA. After he announced that it was justified, they planned a protest.
Yes, yeah, and they did that. It was relatively small. I think about only 25 people came. Compared to right soon after he was shot, I think that there was a couple hundred people in a rally after that. So the rallies are getting a little smaller, but they did protest that, I think, on Tuesday, just saying that this wasn't a justified shooting.
And there are renewed calls for the release of this body cam footage, but still being held onto as evidence.
Yes. Yeah. The ACLU had requested the body cam and that their request had been denied. And they, responded this week saying that they were really disappointed that this wasn't released and that we should, or the public should be able to see what happened and not just rely on the government's version of the events.
I want to remind our listeners that we'd love to hear your thoughts on the stories we're covering today. You can join this conversation with your phone calls, 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller, Abdi Mohammed, who police shot, there's now a warrant out for his arrest on this assault charge?
Well, they actually recalled the warrant. He was in court just a couple of days ago, and he's actually already in the custody of the juvenile court system. He's at his home. He's in community placement based on some previous criminal history. So he's still at home. They recalled that warrant. He has a preliminary hearing, I think in about 2 months from now, where they'll start that process of hearing the evidence, and then the prosecutors will try to get that case bumped into adult court. And if that happens, he faces the same penalties as if he was an adult. So a first-degree felony like that has a maximum penalty of 5 years to life in prison.
Hmm. I believe, and that's a remarkable penalty. I mean, for having been shot four times, I mean, that's a remarkable thing to end up facing as somebody. But I this is just the way the justice system is working. I think that the city said that it was looking at some policy and training changes in the wake of the shooting. What kind of changes are they looking at?
They're considering making more of a formal policy about when body cam footage should be released. I don't know any other details besides that. That was only all they've said so far. So I'm not sure how soon that change or that policy might be put into place.
And then how about, I guess the what we're waiting for next is now for this case to go through through the courts, and then conceivably might there be a release of the body cam footage in after the resolution of this case?
I would imagine that they would at that point. I mean, there's always a conflict in that that Abdi is a juvenile, so I don't know if that will affect whether it can be released or not. I'm not an expert on juvenile rights or what anything like that, so I'm not sure how that could affect it. But presumably, after the criminal case is over, that should be released.
Well, okay. If I might, at some point, couldn't Abdi Muhammad's attorneys want this video release too? They're going to have access to it, and it seems like if the prosecution's claiming that they're protecting the defendant, then the defendant can release it on their own accord, right?
Yeah, I think that's possible, but I would imagine that at this point his defense attorney's concerns are more about getting this case resolved that's most favorable to him. So at this point, if releasing that footage could affect his rights or affect his ability to get a fair trial, they might hold off on that until the case is resolved as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a story that has been interesting to follow for months now, since February when the shooting took place. Right now, though, we're going to have to take another quick break here on Behind the Headlines. When we return, we'll take a look at a new report on the effects of ozone pollution in Salt Lake City. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Yelena Adzik, sitting in for Shad this week. Brendan Canning will be live in Studio Q. He's a founding member of Broken Social Scene, but we'll be talking to him about his new solo record, Home Wrecking Years. That's coming up on Q from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at 1, right here on Utah Public Radio.
The ratings for the Rio Olympics are great, but analysts say that it's mostly because people want to be watching when disaster finally strikes. Who knew Ryan Lochte would actually explode in the middle of the 200-meter freestyle? And Peter Sagal will also be asking legendary journalist Katie Couric about what newspapers she reads. Join us for the news quiz that is just 100% gotcha questions. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Emma Penrod, Robert Gerke, Jessica Miller, and George Pyle. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you as well. 801-355-TALK, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Emma Penrod, environment reporter. A new report has some interesting estimates on the effects of ozone pollution in Salt Lake City and elsewhere. Whose report is this, and what does it say?
Well, this was a joint effort from NYU and the American Thoracic Society. They wanted to quantify, people talk all the time, oh, pollution is harmful, there's this cost, there's that cost. But it's been difficult to quantify those kinds of costs. So that's what they set out to do. They took the risks associated with ozone pollution, and actually also PM2.5, but they didn't do that analysis in Utah.
Okay.
But so they looked at the risks associated with ozone pollution according to all these medical studies. And then they took the local air data, and they took local population, and they said, okay, if there's, such and such percentage risk that you die of a heart attack because you breathed in this ozone, then X number of people will die.
Right.
And they crunched the numbers and did the math, and they came out with these totals for areas all across the nation, how many people will die, how many people will be hospitalized, how many people will get sick and miss work because of pollution.
And specifically because of ozone pollution. And what were the numbers in the Salt Lake City area when it came to deaths that may be attributed to ozone pollution?
Yeah, well, if you look at the Salt Lake City metro area, they said there were about 13 people a year on average that would hypothetically die from ozone pollution. Like I said, they did look at PM2.5 as well, but they only looked at long-term exposure. Hmm. They didn't look at short-term or acute exposure. And in Utah, we actually have good air quality long-term throughout the year as far as PM2.5 is concerned.
Right.
We just have these certain episodes where we get acute or short exposures, which this study didn't consider. So the study came out and said, look, everything's great for PM2.5 in Utah, even though there's a caveat,
right.
And then looked at ozone.
Caveat being, of course, the inversion, the winter inversion,
yes.
Period. And so they're looking at ozone. How does ozone lead to the deaths, the kinds of deaths that they're describing? I mean, or I know this, so just more than a dozen, 12 or 13 deaths per year, statistically speaking, caused by ozone pollution. And this happens how?
Yeah, it's not like, you know, you breathe in ozone and just die on the spot. That doesn't usually happen.
Right.
So it's more like you might have asthma and you might breathe in some ozone and that might trigger an asthma attack and then you don't make it.
Right.
Or especially heart disease is a really common one because it can trigger heart attacks.
Okay.
You're more likely to have a heart attack during episodes of pollution. So you might have a heart attack and die. And so this is part of the reason why you can't like go to the local health department and say, I want to know how many people died of pollution this year.
Right.
You can't do that because they don't put on the death certificate. This person died from pollution most of the time. They say this person died of a heart attack or this person died because they had a respiratory failure or something of that nature.
But not necessarily pointing to the trigger, which could have been, in some instances, ozone pollution.
Mm-hmm.
What is the, generally we have ozone in the summertime as opposed to our wintertime inversion when we're looking at PM2.5, as you said, the particulate pollution. What is the source of ozone pollution in Salt Lake City and where, anywhere?
There isn't actually a direct source of ozone, generally speaking. Ozone is considered a secondary pollutant, meaning it's not emitted into the atmosphere by anything. It's actually created there. So you have primary pollutants that go into the atmosphere, and then when they combine with sunlight, that triggers a chemical reaction that creates the ozone. So this is why we only see, generally speaking, ozone in the summer, because there's more sunlight in the summer. Now, we do have a rare instance in the Uinta area, mm-hmm. in Utah, where we are actually seeing winter pollution, and that phenomenon is not well understood and not well explained. They think maybe the reflective snow or something might have something to do with it. But generally speaking, you need sunlight, and you need some things like volatile organic compounds is a set of chemicals that can contribute to this. Those things come from your car, from your house, from your hairspray, from daily life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tricky thing to nail down.
Okay. Brian Mensch of the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment took some issue with the report, or at least the numbers that were offered by this report on ozone deaths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he felt that this was underestimating the amount of people who are impacted by ozone, and even the number of people who die. And he pointed to some other studies that suggested, you know, one looked at significant impact on people with diabetes and other conditions to show that it could exacerbate those conditions and could contribute to much higher percentages of deaths. So, you know, there's scientific opinion all over the map on the precise numbers.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting. Maybe I'll bring you in on this, George Pyle. We tend to think about the pollution that we have or a pollution issue that we have, mm-hmm. during inversions in the winter when it's very visible,
yeah.
and you can see it. But in the summer, we have these ozone events, ozone problems.
Yeah.
I guess my question for you is, you know, how aware do you think our population is of this, and how aware should they be?
Well, it's interesting how you can get used to just about anything, and you'd think the winter inversions are at their worst during the legislative session. So you'd think that might cause the legislature to take some action, but they are always so concerned about how it would be a job killer or it would raise the costs of anything from pumping gas to running a refinery that they're reluctant to do anything. They spend most of their time crabbing at the federal government for the rules they try and put in. But, you know, in other areas of life, you know, we regulate liquor and drugs, and there are lots of things that where we've made a decision as a state that we won't go there even if it would make us money. There are things we won't do for money. But apparently we'll continue to pollute our air for money.
Emma Penrod, I want to bring you back. How much could regulation do in terms of dealing with ozone pollution? I mean, you say it comes from everyday, you know, our everyday living experience, but, you know, different fuels maybe, different fuel standards. This would probably have an effect.
And that's a tough question to quantify precisely because the situation is different in different areas. In some places, it may be primarily vehicles that contribute to the problem. Now, we do have secondary PM 2.5 as well, and that vehicles have been attributed to that as the primary source. But buildings are rapidly becoming the primary sources. Vehicles are getting cleaner, and we're building more houses that aren't, you know, necessarily incredibly more efficient than
they were
older. Yeah. I mean, they are more efficient, but, you know, could be more, some have argued. And then you have things like, you know, when we talk about these volatile organic compounds, the number one source of those in most areas of Utah is just biological things, plants, animals, people. And, you know, so this is a question that now that the EPA has reduced the standard is going to have to be debated by regulators and by scientists is exactly how do you deal with this issue of where the sources of primary pollutants that contribute to ozone come from. It's not a clean cut, just tell people to stop emitting ozone.
Right. Well, it's something that needs looking at and I guess studying further. Guys, we had other stories that we wanted to talk about with you, but because our time is as low as it is, we'll have to leave it there and turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And just because I've got you here, Emma, what's your pick for this week?
I guess I'll pick the story that got cut then. We are... That works.
That makes sense.
The other story, there was a spill of sorts of coal ash into the Price River last week. There was a flash flood on Thursday, and there were some flooding, you know, preventative safeguards in place or being constructed at the site of this ash landfill where they've put the coal ash from the carbon plant, which is now closed.
Right.
And during that flash flood, a culvert filled up with debris, and the water went out of the culvert and went right over the pile of ash and washed a so far unknown quantity of coal ash into the Price River.
And pretty dangerous stuff. I mean, can be...
High concentrations of heavy metals.
Wow. Well, underplayed, unfortunately, this week by Emma Penrod. Jessica Miller, how about yourself?
Well, this is a good week to look at the Hike of the Week blog, which is kind of related to justice because there's a lot of us justice reporters who contribute to it. But this week, we've got a photographer who did the Hike of the Week up at Mount Tipinogos, and his pictures are amazing, like way better than anything that we usually do. And reporter Erin Alberti is writing a blog about she's going to 12 national parks this year with her three-year-old daughter, and she's been kind of recounting some of that recently. So it's a good time to look at Hike of the Week.
Hike of the Week by Jessica Miller. Robert Gricke, how about yourself?
I think you guys talked about this last week, but the Facebook, the effort to lure Facebook here, there's been, they had a meeting last week. It appears that even though Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams is upset about this, there may not be much he can do. Mike Gurrell's been following this, as is Matt Piper, and I think it's something that's worth following. A $240 million incentive for 70 to 100 jobs, it's a big ticket item.
Fascinating. Facebook trying to get Facebook's data center here. George Pyle, how about your underplayed story?
Well, in an effort to maybe write off my trip to San Francisco as a business expense, we were in San Francisco last week. The headquarters of Twitter, the headquarters of Airbnb, and right in front of those places are more homeless people than you can imagine. I mean, you think it's bad here.
Wow.
It's bad in San Francisco. We get these new, we're shooting for the high-tech industries. What happens when you get high-tech industries? Rents go up.
Yeah.
That's the subject of my column that'll be posted today and Sunday. Mayor Ben McAdams is out with his plan for how to deal with homeless. So at least somebody's got a plan.
We will have to check it out. And George Pyle, thank you for that as well. Jessica Miller, Emma Penrod, Robert Gerke, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up today with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks about fireworks and revenge. Robert Kirby, July was fireworks season, and it's a time of year when a person's neighbors can really piss them off. And you found yourself pretty pissed off by your neighbor recently because of fireworks.
It was a neighbor whose name shall go unmentioned. But yeah, I mean, there are ordinances about when you can set off fireworks and when they have to stop and that sort of thing and the celebrations that go on with it, which for most people are immaterial to the subject at hand, which is we get to blow stuff up,
right?
You know.
But there's, I mean, there's sort of common sense, good etiquette when you're blowing stuff up.
Good neighbor etiquette, good, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently your neighbor wasn't following that etiquette.
No, and I think he thought he could get away with it because I have cannons in my garage that I'll sometimes shoot in my backyard. I try to send out an email to all the neighbors saying, around this time you'll hear a loud boom because I'm testing something.
Yeah.
And if they write back and say, no, my kid will be asleep or something like that, then okay, fine, I won't do it. That's the consideration I give them.
Okay, well, flash forward to a moment in time when you are sitting on your, well, standing on your neighbor's porch. It's late at night, and you are considering ringing their doorbell, not because they're launching off fireworks at that exact moment, but because
they kept me awake when I was trying to sleep, and I wanted to wake them up. It was actually 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was standing there on his porch with my finger on his doorbell, thinking, okay, this is payback time. I know he's in there asleep because I know he has to go to work tomorrow. And I thought, this is a way for me to get the point across. He kept me awake till 1 o'clock in the morning, time to get even.
Well, and you had a kind of imagined dialogue of how it might go.
Yeah, maybe you could imagined that Ernie would stagger blearily to the door. And Ernie, Curb, it's almost 4. What's going on? Me, oh, I noticed that you stopped setting off your fireworks 2 hours ago. I wanted to make sure everything is okay. Ernie, what? Dude, we were asleep. Me, yeah, so was I 3 hours ago. By then, the entire Ernie household would be awake. The dogs are barking and Ernie is yelling at them to shut up. Slowly gathering his wits, he realizes that this is a payback visit. Him, come on, man, it's just once a year. Me, no, it's not. It's Independence Day, Pioneer Day, Harriman Days, and 4 or 5 days either side of each of those days. Ernie launches into our neighbor noise history, bringing up the subject of my cannons. He points out the time that I shot a flaming stuffed bear into his aspen trees and the time I gave his sister's dog a nervous breakdown. I counter with the fact that I have the courtesy to send out gang emails to all the neighbors at least an hour before I set off anything big. Also, the bear didn't burn anything important, and the dog was no bigger than a radish and therefore entirely useless.
So this is an ongoing sort of feud between you and your neighbor.
It's a semi-feud in that we actually like each other, but we also get on each other's nerves.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of being a good neighbor is something that you have to work at. You can't be a good neighbor just by ignoring the other person.
Right.
You actually have to establish some sort of relationship wherein, if you do have a problem, you can talk about it sensibly instead of ringing their doorbell in the middle of the night.
And in the end, did you do it?
In the end, I didn't, because I knew that Ernie's wife wouldn't call the police. She'd call my wife, and then I'd really be in trouble.
Again, that's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find the full Kirby archives at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Connor Rivers at UPR, and the Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great weekend.
Are you looking for a way to make your nonprofit organization more visible to our statewide community? Utah Public Radio's community calendar highlights events across the state, including musical performances, festivals, live theater, art shows, dance, educational or guest lectures, workshops, volunteer opportunities, and more. We have a new, more user-friendly submission page. Just visit the UPR website at upr.org and click on the community calendar link. There, you can review the submission guidelines. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.